people in our culture today are too often, they're just malnourished. There's not enough reality in their notion of who they are and of what society and morality and politics and art are. We need to nourish ourselves. We need to go to the feast of reality, and art is the occasion to feast on the real.
Welcome to Purposeful Lab, a Maja Center podcast. I'm Catherine Hajo with my co-host, Dr. Daniel Keebler. And in this episode, we're still discussing art, but expanding it a bit.
Yeah, we're going to be looking at the philosophy of art and looking at a philosopher and speaking with a philosopher who does art. It's sort of a unique combination.
Absolutely. And it's another Dan, Dr. Daniel McInerney. He's a novelist and a dramatist, as well as an associate professor and the chair of the philosophy department at Christendom College in Front Royal, Virginia. His novel, The Good Death of Kate Monclair, which we discuss in this conversation, was hailed by fellow Catholic novelists as an instant classic of 21st century Catholic fiction. He has a new play, The Actor, that will premiere at Christendom in the fall of 2024, and a Substack to follow along for those who are interested, called The Comic Muse. And with Dr. McInerney, we'll discuss how fiction affects culture, but it's also a reflection of culture as well. And with that, here's our conversation with Dr. Daniel McInerney.
Daniel, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on.
It's fantastic to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no, just to put in context why we have you as a guest and you're a perfect fit for what we're talking about. You know, we've been looking at the order in sort of the universe and the physics and the chemistry and the biology and what that points to in the human person. A few episodes in last season, we've looked at sort of what it means to be human from a philosophical perspective. But there's one thing that we haven't looked at too much, and that was, you know, human art, right? And something that's sort of unique to human culture and to humans. And you tie these two together as a philosopher and an artist, right? So I just want to have you share sort of what got you interested in these two, what often might seem to someone in the opposite ends of the spectrum, where philosophy is sort of logical reasoning and then art is more creative, right?
Right.
How you tie them together and what brought you into that?
Well, I first of all, I come by it genetically.
Okay.
my father, Ralph McInerney, was both a novelist and a philosopher. So it was coming through my genes first and foremost.
Yeah.
But speaking biographically a little bit more, as a child, I was an artist. Everyone knew me as the kid who drew cartoons, and being an artist was my first identity, sense of myself. It was what I wanted to do. I was going to be an animator at Walt Disney Studios, and that was who I was. As an undergraduate, I encountered philosophy for the first time, and it was perhaps especially in a course on the philosophy of art that I was invited to think more theoretically about this activity that I loved more than anything else. And I realized I like thinking about what this means. And slowly, as my thinking developed, I began to realize more fully that art is a way in which we human beings seek for and find meaning. Certainly not the only way. We do it theologically, we do it philosophically, we do it in sciences, and many other ways, but art is one of the principal ways, and I would suggest it's one of the more common and popular ways in which we human beings reflect on our lives and try to make sense of who we are and what we're doing here.
Yeah, and is there something unique that we can reflect on in art that reflecting as an artist that you can't do as a philosopher or as a scientist? So, what is that dimension that makes it almost so attractive?
Right. Yes. So if we're talking about theology, philosophy, the sciences, we're in the realm of the abstract. We're in the realm of theory. We're in the realm of ideas. We're not dealing with particulars, the particular of my life, of your lives. What art does, and this is, I think, the magic of it, this is, I think, what captivates us more than anything else about it, is it allows us to think about meaning, think about ideas, reflect, while not losing touch with the singular, the particular, the experiential in our lives. We can have both of those at the same time in a work of art. So you're seeing on the screen, for example, a person,
yeah.
right, mm-hmm. in a place, in all of the particulars of their situation, and yet it's radiating a certain meaning and hopefully a certain truth to us. That we just love that. We're embodied spirits. So a purely intellectual or theoretical endeavor takes us more up into the spiritual end of our nature, and we can tend to forget the more embodied side. Art, again, enables us to kind of bring the theoretical, the intellectual together with embodiment, particularity. And as I said, we just can't get enough of that
yeah.
as human beings.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've already mentioned your father, Ralph McInerney, who himself was a philosopher and successful novelist. Tell us about your father and what was it like growing up in the McInerney household?
Yeah, I think the first thing I would say is I didn't know I was growing up with Ralph McInerney. That is quote unquote. He was my dad, and I thank God for that. He was a wonderful father. It was only later, my undergraduate years, my graduate studies, where I became aware of the Ralph McInerney known by people I don't know, and that took me aback when people would mention him to me. Mm-hmm. And my first thought would always be, how do you know my dad? And why are you talking about my dad in so familiar a way? I kind of had to get used to that.
Yeah.
But then I fell in with a bad crowd and I went into the same field that he did. And then I'm studying philosophy. And I realized that at very least in the world of Catholic philosophy and well beyond it, he was a rock star. And that was a wonderful thing to encounter. But that's not what I grew up with. It was just dad. And he was a marvelous example. And but it was a development to understand him as kind of scholar, writer, kind of Catholic public intellectual.
And it sounds like your household really helped cultivate your skills as an artist. You said you started young.
Yes, yes. No, my parents, my siblings very much encouraged me and laughed and enjoyed my cartooning. My father, who worked in those years when I was a kid in an unfurnished basement, not an attractive place to work at all, but he would set me up on an old Royal typewriter on a high chair. He would give me a stack of typing paper, carbon paper, which we used in those days when he wanted to make duplicates. And he would just say, imagine. And I would write stories. I would imitate him because I would see him at his typewriter banging away, and I would bang away, and I would write, I think, again, thinking of Walt Disney, I was writing scripts, you know, directed by Daniel McInerney, produced by Daniel McInerney, written by Daniel McInerney. It's a best boy, Daniel
McInerney. So anyway, a one-man show.
He was a great, great person to imitate. It was a great household to encourage me. Absolutely.
Well, speaking of writing, your latest book, Chrism Press, released last year, The Good Death of Kate Monclair. Can you tell us what it's about and the main themes?
Yeah. I think it's best to start here, thinking about culture. One of the chief tasks of any culture is to help us make sense out of and to prepare for death. I mean, if you think of Catholic culture, that's you could describe all of Catholic culture in just that way. It's helping us make sense out of the phenomenon of our finitude. Death is the chief marker of our fallenness. Salvation is principally about saving us from a death that doesn't lead to our homeland in heaven. I was interested in a character facing death who did not really have a culture, that did not have any help in making sense out of death. So my character, my protagonist, Kate Monclair, is a woman. She's in her mid-50s. She doesn't have faith, doesn't really have any strong philosophical or religious beliefs, but she receives a grave diagnosis. She has an aggressive form of brain cancer. It's inoperable. She's dying. And no spoiler, she does die. I tell you that in the title of the book. It's the good death of Kate Moncler. There's no miraculous cure at the end. The story is about how she's going to face that death. So without a culture, or if she has a culture, it's the culture of do your best to ignore it. Do your best to keep death out of your mind.
Busy yourself.
Yeah, busy yourself. She now can't do that anymore because death is staring her right in the face. So I was interested, what does a person in that situation do? So Kate Moncler, maybe as any of us would do in that situation, she flails. She does something that she would not normally ever do. She goes to a death discussion group that she sees advertised on the bulletin board of a coffee shop. And lo and behold, it's moderated by an old friend of hers. It's in the experience of that discussion group that the idea by her old friend is first floated. Maybe you should take your own life. You're facing extreme suffering. There's no way out. It seems absolutely meaningless. Why don't you just shorten the path and commit an act of euthanasia? And early in the book, she decides to do just that. But here I won't spoil.
Okay.
I will just say that's not the end of the story. Yeah. So it's a book about what it means for somebody without a religious or even philosophical culture facing death and how they might do it.
That seems to be something that's sort of maybe unique to our modern culture.
So,
we don't have a culture, something to cling on to in terms of meaning. So how, you're looking at art over, the millennia. How do you see, so this meaning making in art related to, making good decisions and the virtue or the ends of life or what is my life for? How does that change over time? Is it just culturally, each culture picks their own, this is the purpose of life? Or do we see, in different literary cultures, the same literary themes and the same sort of struggle for meaning? And do they just construct it? That's one of the things that sort of moderns, construct our own meaning.
That's right.
Is that what we see as we look at sort of the grand sweep of literature? Is that something maybe unique to the 20th century?
It's a complicated question. Yeah. I think it's worth saying this first. I think all art from any tradition in any time period from any artist is speaking to our ethical or our moral life. That doesn't mean that their stories or their art is necessarily about a moral dilemma or some moral rule or commandment is at the center of the drama. I mean it more generally, that every work of art has to do with human beings pursuing their happiness, pursuing their fulfillment, and either succeeding or failing. And that's the ethical life, broadly conceived. That's how we conceive of it in the Catholic tradition, going back to Aristotle, that the moral life, the ethical life, is the search for happiness. So I think you can look at any work of art, especially stories, but even paintings, sculpture, I would say even music without lyrics, and you can understand it as a way of expressing that quest for happiness. Okay. Then things get complicated.
Yeah.
Because then you get to different cultures, different outlooks, different takes on happiness.
Right, yeah.
Right. And so you're going to find different literary traditions, traditions of painting, traditions of drama. You're going to find variety, division, even conflict. So you're going to find, especially as Western culture has, I think we can fairly say, disintegrated a fair amount, you're going to find, especially in the 20th and 21st centuries, you're going to find works of art that are going to challenge that there even is a happiness for human beings to pursue. I'm thinking of one of the most famous plays of the 20th century, the Irish writer Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot,
mm-hmm.
right? Which does just that. It questions whether there is a fulfillment for human beings. And if there's not, what do we do?
Yeah.
What do we do? So we can't say that every single work of art is picturing or manifesting the very same understanding of happiness, one that would be congenial to us as Catholics. You're going to find variety and division and conflict. But I don't think that's the end of the story either. I think beauty shines through. I think greatness in work of art, in works of art, does shine through. I think the greatness of Shakespeare, for example, outshines that of Beckett. I think the greatness of Dante or Tolkien, say, outshines many of the novelists writing today. So I think beauty will out, as we say.
Yeah.
But there is a great variety of traditions.
So art, you can see, I mean, as a scientist, I think science over the ages, it reveals the underlying philosophy and goals of that culture. And it seems like very much, you know, medieval science was quite different, and they were asking different questions and had different concerns and underlying philosophies than, say, modern science. But there's a continuity there because we're trying to get at the understand the natural world. And it seems like with art, there's a continuity there, but it reveals an underlying issues that the society is going through at the time. So how would you as a judge good art versus bad art, right? You know, because there is certainly art that, it's from a Catholic perspective, it's moral, it's so forth, but it's just bad art, right? Yeah. You know, so
you put your finger on something important. Whenever you're going to evaluate a work of art, there's at least two levels. There's sort of, call it the meaning level, ideas level of the piece, and then you get to the more technical craft dimension of the piece. We've all seen them. There can be great films and television shows, about saints or biblical characters, where the meaning level, it's unimpeachable, it's wonderful, it's edifying. But technically, there are some drawbacks. The craftness of whatever the genre is lacking in some way. We don't want to justify a lack of craft by saying, well, at least it has this. We want excellence wherever we go. We're called to excellence. And so we want to marry the good ideas with the excellence and craft, but they can come apart.
Yeah.
And I think we see that a lot. Not to call out any specific project, but I think we see that a lot in the Christian and Catholic media world. We'll just cheer and applaud a specific project because there's a good message, but the actual execution is maybe not excellent.
And the culture wars have not always been friendly, at least to the Catholic understanding of art. We let the very good and sincere desire to change the world to sometimes override the technical and the craft aspects of it. And we have to really be on our guard not to let that happen.
Because to your point, the excellence actually speaks through more loudly.
Yeah, more loudly, yes. If you're going to get people to hear the message, they have to be compelled by it purely as a work of art. A work of art, in short, cannot stand upon criteria external to art. We can't call it great, we can't call it important just because it's speaking to something outside the world of art. It has to succeed as a work of art first and foremost.
If you were to take a pulse of how we're doing in the U.S. right now in 2024 when it comes to popular entertainment, what diagnosis would you give when it comes to our culture and art?
Meaty question. It's an interesting time. We're seeing in 2024 what I would call the decline, slow, maybe not so slow, of legacy media across all the genres of entertainment, especially film and television especially, but I would think even in the publishing world. The old standbys, the Disney Corporation, for example, no one's going hungry who works for the Disney Corporation, but they're not achieving their own aims in the culture anymore. They're losing part of their audience. The democratization that technology brings, think of streaming platforms, enables production companies like Angel Studios, who makes The Chosen and the recent film on Mother Cabrini, makes it possible for a group like that to crowdfund, to get an audience, and to get some really impressive traction in the culture. So it's an interesting time of shifting ground. And Catholics and other Christians are doing some great things to take advantage of that. And that's fantastic. Again, you see it not just in film and TV, but in the literary world, and I'm sure in other arts as well. But it's always a challenge, especially to compete with those vehicles that are very much in the mainstream and have the mainstream funding, the mainstream distribution, the mainstream marketing. We're just coming off of award season and in the film industry for a project coming out of the Christian or Catholic world to compete with an Oscar winner. We're not quite there yet. But the audiences that we are able to win are not negligible. And I think that's exciting. So that doesn't get to everything in your question, but it's interesting to note. It's a time of great shifts, and I think we would be savvy to take advantage of those.
Yeah. Well said.
Yeah. And what opportunities, what do you see as the opportunities for Catholic Christian artists in that milieu? Is there a danger there of these opportunities? Is it all positive, the fact that there is more democratization of that?
Right. There's always the danger that we've already talked about, that craft will be sacrificed in a very earnest desire to get kind of a message piece out into the world. So that's there. It's always going to be there. We always have to be on guard for that. I look at the situation mostly positively, though, that people are realizing I don't need to go to New York or Los Angeles or London to get something done. I pitch my novel to New York agents, got a lot of silence, got some nice remarks back, but no sale in the end. So I went into the more independent and finally into a Christian Catholic arm of a Christian publisher, and very happy to do so. That's kind of what you have to do, but that opportunity is there.
Yeah.
Again, we could go to other arts, and there are similar opportunities. If you're a painter, if you're just an illustrator, you can get your work out there this afternoon. There's a lot of competition out there. It doesn't mean it's going to be easy, but there's distribution there that wasn't available before, and Catholics should be taking advantage of that.
Yeah, great. Talk a little bit about your sort of academic work and your teaching and philosophy of art course, because there's something that's unique to human culture and ubiquitous, this art that we're drawn towards something beyond ourselves, this transcendental nature of art. It's almost points to something unique about humans. But as you mentioned, it all art is looking about what does it mean to live the good life or happiness? So it's tied up with virtue in a sense, right?
Right.
So,
absolutely.
How do you, frame that in your class? Like, what's the connection there with virtue and art, and how do you?
Art is linked to transcendence, but we want to think about what does it mean to transcend? What are we transcending, and what are we transcending toward? To transcend means literally means you're going over something, right? You're going beyond something. So what is it that we're going beyond in a work of art? What I would say, we're going beyond our ego. We're going beyond our self-concern. We're going beyond our own emotional life. We're going beyond just our mere subjectivity, our mere wants and desires. What a great work of art does, it transcends that world. I was saying earlier that we love art because it retains our particularity, and we want it to retain the particularities of the human experience, but not that which is just merely about me. So great art is going to take us into the realm of what is really fulfilling for human beings, what really makes us happy, what is my ego really desiring? What are these passions for? Great art will give us the end. End in the sense of not chronological end, but end in the sense of perfection. What is the perfection that we human beings are thirsting for? Mm-hmm. Art will give us a picture of that. But again, not just on the abstract level, but showing us this individual struggling for that, at least the greatest.
Yeah, and I think that's what your book, this Kate Monclair, you're posing this question that she's struggling with. It's not a question that's unique to her.
Yes.
It's something that we all have to deal with. And now, so in your opinion, does good art then answer that question, or does it raise the question and sort of frame it for people to think about, right? Or does it just tell them the answer? And, is that a bad distinction there that I'm making?
No, it's a good one. We never want to put great art in a box. There's such variety, even amongst the greatest works of art. So great art will do lots of different sorts of things.
Okay.
We can think of examples of great stories that show us the full meaning of human life. Right. I'm thinking of Dante's Divine Comedy.
Okay.
Nothing in that poem
he's got it
missing,
all. Yeah.
In regard to what's essential for our flourishing as human beings. It's all there, right? Other works of art, while still having that rich sense, won't take us all the way there. They may show us a character struggling, not even knowing that's the end, struggling to find a certain sense of fulfillment and failing. But the failure is instructive. Now, that's a tricky maneuver to pull off, because you have to, the artist has to indicate that the failure is meant to be instructive of something more. To pull that off well, we'd have to talk more about the craft end of things. So that's a very...
Yeah, it's a danger of just making it nihilistic.
Yeah, that's right.
Everybody dies in the end.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think of certain of the novels of one of my favorites, the 20th century Catholic novelist, Yves Lenoir, will do that. He'll take us all the way, say, in Brideshead Revisited, perhaps his greatest novel. He'll show us the character going all the way toward conversion and faith and renewal of life. But in other of his novels, he'll show us a kind of fiasco and characters comically, blackly comically, falling short of their goal, but in a way that is instructive.
You're talking about how great art points us towards, you know, what we're all yearning towards.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, you know, can we as Catholics think there is good art coming from someone who is ideologically opposed to us, who has, you know, different answers to the big questions?
Right. That's a great question. It's a question my students often ask me. I think it's one we're all compelled by. A few minutes ago, I mentioned that play by Samuel Beckett, Waiting for Godot. It'd be hard for me to imagine a work of art more antithetical to my own beliefs and commitments than that one. Yet, I've taught it in my classrooms. I enjoy it to a certain degree. Do I think it's great art? It's certainly fascinating art. I'll say that. I'm interested in Beckett and his characters, as I was with my own protagonist, Kate Monclair, trying to puzzle through what it means to live in a life that, from their own point of view at least, is drained of meaning. So I think we can find interest, fascination. We can be compelled by a work of art that espouses an outlook that is not our own. I think that's true. If only for purely craft reasons, the use of color, the acting, the cinematography, for example, we can admire those things and abhor the quote-unquote message of the film. I think you can have, I guess I want to think of a spectrum. I think you can have great works of art that are not consummately Catholic in their outlook, but to a certain degree. I think the greatest works of art that human beings have made are the works that manifest the true meaning of human life, but also marry it to that consummate level of craft we've been talking about. So it's a scale. But I think the greatest works will be ones that are true in every sense. Yeah.
And that'll shine through.
Right.
Your latest endeavor is a play called The Actor, and I believe it will be shown at Christendom
this
spring.
It's going to premiere at Christendom College this fall.
That's the plan. That's really exciting. And it's about St. John Paul II's cultural resistance in the form of theater.
Yes.
Tell us about this play. We'd love to hear about it and your vision for The Actor.
I would love it. Well, it begins with my own love of drama. I've directed high school drama in the past. I'm involved with Christendom's theater group, at least as the faculty mentor. I have always admired great acting and stagecraft in particular. And so when I learned that the young Carol Wojtyla would become St. Pope John Paul II, himself as a young man wanted to be an actor, I was intrigued and began to read and study about that time in his life. And it became especially intriguing because his theatrical activities were pursued in the midst of war, all right, while Poland was being occupied by the Nazis in the Second World War. So I came up with this story that would track that period of his life. So my play is called The Actor, and it concerns just that period in his life, pretty much from the Nazi invasion, which was September 1, 1939, to the time when he entered the seminary, which I believe was the fall of 1941. So it's not a very long period in his life. But as soon as the Nazis invaded, he and his friends, he was a college student. He was at the Jagiellonian University in Krakow in Poland. And they tried to keep up their studies underground. That didn't last very long. They were shooting many other professors was one of the problems. But he and his friends got the idea, our Polish culture is they're trying to cancel it. They're trying to destroy it. We have to keep that flame burning. And so they took their activities underground, and it began very small in a room like this with a few friends. They would move the furniture and they would put on plays. The great plays of Polish romantic literature, 19th century works for the most part. And they kept that flame alive, and people would risk their lives every time they rehearsed, but especially when they had a show and people would have to come, and staggered. They couldn't all come at once to an apartment. People would risk their lives for a piece of theater. And I just thought that was wonderful drama in and of itself.
Yeah. Was it effective in resisting those Nazi ideologies during that time?
Yeah. I don't know if you can quantify it. Because we're asking, did it keep a culture alive, which we're asking, are people's lives being changed? Are people being nourished? Are people being encouraged? And we can't put a number on that. We can't measure it. But certainly, by all accounts, people were enthusiastic about the shows they were on. We're not talking about huge numbers because the shows were in living rooms. But nonetheless, there was great enthusiasm for what they were doing. They eventually founded a group called the Rhapsodic Theater. That wasn't what it was at the very beginning of the war. And that continued after the war. It was shut down twice by the communists, once in the 50s, and then ultimately in the 1970s. So it did survive the war some decades. So in that respect, that's quite successful. I think any theater company would be pretty happy with several decades of existence, especially under such oppression.
As you've delved into St. John Paul II's life during those 2 years in particular, were you struck by anything, or can you speak about how, fiction and plays and art, how that was a refuge for him during that time?
Yes, it was. But also what interests me is that the deeper he dove into his theatrical activities, the more his vocation to the priesthood called him. And that maybe was the real dramatic heart of my play, is trying, what was happening that the more he threw himself into theater, he really wanted to be a professional actor, and he was good enough to do it. The deeper he went in, the more God was using that to call him. God wanted him to be on a stage, not just the world stage, but the stage of the altar. He wanted him to do what actors do, to bring a real presence to life. So I like to play with all the double meanings there of acting, of real presence, of the actor in the priesthood. I called the play The Actor to have more than one meaning.
Yeah.
So it's God was taking him away from the activity that he was attracting him to. I find that very interesting. Maybe that happens with all of us to one.
Is that an aspect of good art that it speaks to, you know, the particular of the character, but it also speaks to the particular of the reader or the person looking at the art, right?
And yes.
Yeah.
It's art that was true, so it probably just brings him even closer to truth himself.
Yeah, we should keep him. That's a good point. We should keep in mind that the plays that they were performing were you know, deeply spiritual plays. They weren't doing comedies, right? They weren't doing musicals. These were very serious sort. We would think of them as very kind of cerebral kind of theater, and the way that they staged them was more like a poetry reading than a full-fledged drama. It was minimalist theater because they were really emphasizing the word. They wanted the word to sink into people's hearts and minds. So it was about the language, but it was a very philosophical and indeed religious language in these plays. So there was a connection to the spiritual life.
And you mentioned the name of this group was the Rhapsodic Theater.
Eventually, they called themselves the Rhapsodic Theater. Yes.
With something like the Rhapsodic Theater, you know, do we need something like that today in 2024 to push back against?
Always. It was just an impressive form of cultural resistance, the Rhapsodic Theater. We are not living in a land overrun by our oppressors. We still enjoy a decent amount of freedom in our time, but I am not here to argue against the view that our culture is in deep decline and that there is oppression all around us and great evil all around us, and we need to resist that. Art is always compelling. It is a fantastic form of resistance. So yeah, we need to, as it were, we need to put on the plays in the sitting room or the garage or whatever. We need to bootstrap the production company. We need to found the independent publisher. We need to find ways to get people to show their paintings and their sculpture and their music. As we were talking about earlier, it's a time of shifting grounds, and we need to find every way that we can to get our work out into the world, not forgetting mainstream venues. I don't want to just discount those. It's a more complicated discussion, but we shouldn't forget about them.
Yeah, that's something, this theme, like we talked about, culture influences art, but this is the opposite. Holding on to your art influences the culture. And that's something that's deeply embedded in JP too, in his thought and the way he saw art. Is that something that's influenced you into what you're doing with your art?
Absolutely. I mean, I was saying earlier too, we can't judge a work of art by criteria that are outside of art. Granted, but there's still a distinction to be made. We still want the work of art to teach the world.
Yeah.
Right? I certainly do. I want to move hearts and minds with what I make. I want the world to be a better place. However, as an artist, because of that desire, I have to double down on the craft aspect. I have to make it so good that the non-believer or someone who is really deeply antithetical to the faith will still be compelled by it. That's our real challenge.
Right.
It's a big one.
Yeah, definitely. So you write a lot about art and philosophy and stuff. You have a Substack.
I do.
To share sort of what you do on there and what types of articles you put up.
Yes. It's my Substack is called The Comic Muse.
Okay.
It's not about comic books. I call it the comic muse because it's the muse, which I take to be the Holy Spirit ultimately, which animates it, is one that is ultimately comic in the grand traditional sense, leading us toward ultimate fulfillment,
right. Okay.
Leading us to God ultimately. I write about art almost exclusively. I have a series right now on the question we've been discussing, the relationship between art and transcendence. What does it mean for art to transcend? And I kind of taking a phrase from the Catholic novelist Walker Percy, I call the artists of our time ontologically impoverished, which is to say they're malnourished. They don't have enough. Ontologically just simply means it has to do with reality, right? Not just artists, but people in our culture today are too often, they're just malnourished. There's not enough reality in their notion of who they are and of what society and morality and politics and art are. We're shrunken. And so I'm trying in a playful way to bring back a sense that no, we need to nourish ourselves. We need to go to the feast of reality, and art is the occasion to feast on the real, one of the occasions at least.
As we start to wind down this conversation, which has been so enlightening, some follow-up questions that come to mind is, one, is there any advice you have for our listeners and viewers right now, how they can nourish themselves on good art, anywhere you want to point them to in particular?
And I do.
Any advice you have for young artists today as they're navigating this changing landscape?
Yes. I love to speak to young artists whenever I meet them, whether it's on campus, at Christendom, where I teach, or anywhere. This is the advice I give. This is the advice given by the comedian Steve Martin to any young comic who would come to him and say, Steve, how do I get that gig? How do I get an agent? How do I make it in the film business? How do I achieve some kind of success? Steve Martin would say, and it would typically be taken sort of as the rich young man in the gospel takes the advice. He says, be so good they can't ignore you. And just let that sink in a minute. Be so good they can't ignore you. That is to say, don't worry so much about the practicalities of how to achieve success. Of course, you have to do what you have to do, right? Send your headshot out there, or market your work, start a Substack, do whatever you need to do. But your primary task is to be so good, again, to double down on the craft, on the technique of whatever it is, stand-up comedy or writing novels, and get to a point where you're so good that nobody, whether they see the world like you do or not, can ignore you. I mean, I'm happy to talk about, finding an agent, a publisher, et cetera. That's a great conversation. Mm-hmm. But the first conversation I want to have is, how are you becoming excellent? Let's talk about how that happens. I'd recommend a book, not by an artist, but by a man, your viewers may know, Cal Newport, who is a professor of computer science at Georgetown University, but he also writes more popular books about work life in our technological age. But he wrote a book a few years back called, taking this story from Steve Martin, the book is called So Good They Can't Ignore You. And he talks about, no matter what your field is, we can apply it to the arts, approaching your life as craft and really focusing on the excellence of craft. And I've learned a lot. I recommend that to my own kids, to students, all young artists viewing today.
Yeah, the excellence comes first, and the logistics are easier than the, that's the hard part.
Yeah, hopefully they will, the logistics will come to you, as it were. Yeah.
And finally, you have a new book coming out this summer, I believe,
I do.
With Word on Fire Academic, Beauty and Imitation, A Philosophical Reflection on the Arts. Can you give us a little preview?
I think I just did. our whole conversation is that book. We've been talking about the very heart of it. It's about an understanding of the arts that connects it to transcendence, to beauty. I wouldn't call it a beach read, but at the same time, it's not a book just for scholars. I really tried to hit the sweet spot where a popular very interested audience could really enjoy the book. And I talk about most of the major arts in it. I have a chapter on poetry, painting, music, cinema, theater. So
sounds like a great,
oh, people
a great
enjoy book. It. Coming yeah, out in yeah. June from Excellent. Word on Fire Academic.
Well, Dr. Daniel McInerney, thank you so much for your time. It's been a joy to speak with you.
Thank you both. This has great. Been just tremendous fun. Thank you.
It really was a joy to speak with Daniel and to hear his perspective on art. I could have, you know, spoken with him at length. Two things that stood out to me from what he said, how good art helps us to make sense with death and how death is, you know, a reflection of our fallen nature as humans. And so art is us grappling and with death, and also how good art reflects our pursuit for happiness. It seems like those two things would be opposite, happiness and death, and yet both are a part of good, beautiful art.
Yeah, I think the interesting point that he made about death, that we all have to confront that. So then that raises the question of what am I living for, right? And that leads to happiness, right? What does it mean for me to be happy or to live a good life? So I think, you know, that when we confront our death, and what he was talking about in his book, this woman confronts her death. Well, what does it mean? Is there any meaning to my life and who I am? That's something not only you find in good art, but what we've been discussing on the podcast.
It forces you to seek that purpose.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. Was there anything else that stood out to you?
Yeah, I think one of the things right at the end where he's talking about, you know, so what makes a good artist and what advice he gives to young artists, and I think this is advice that you give to any young person, is excellence. And it's like, strive for excellence in what you do. Don't do anything half-hearted. You know, if you're going to do it as to the best of your ability, because excellence in medicine, in science, in philosophy, in art, in journalism, in anything is going to be what is going to draw people to you. If you're not excellent, you aren't going to be able to influence the culture.
That's what's effective. You know, St. John Paul II was excellent, and it seemed everything that he did. And that's what drew so many people in. And it seems excellence is also virtuous.
Right.
Too. So really fascinating conversation. And with that, now questions for you, Dan,
right.
The other Dan, as we turn now to our office hours segment. So in the news, just throughout this year, we're going to be seeing this topic of in vitro fertilization related to different cases throughout the United States. And it's bringing to the surface a lot of bioethical questions, biological questions. So speaking to you as a Catholic biologist, can you just first off explain what is the church's teaching when it comes to in vitro fertilization?
Yeah, Catherine, it's a good question. And it's one of those questions that's very difficult for people to come to terms with, because it often seems the church's position on IVF is sort of not sympathetic to couples that might be infertile. So, you know, the church teaches that IVF is immoral because it separates sort of what at the heart of the marriage act being both unitive and procreative, right? And that, you know, a life is the out. A new life is a gift of the self between the married couple. And so when you take that away from the marriage act, it becomes disordered, right? And that doesn't mean someone that's conceived via IVF is disordered. They're a full human person, and the church teaches that. But when you separate the unitive and procreative aspects of the sexual act, you do something that is causes a disruption at the heart of the marriage. And that's why, you know, contraception is sort of the other side of that, right? So IVF and contraception go together in terms of the teaching of the church, because contraception separates the procreative act from the unitive act, where you don't have a full self gift, right? And then IVF separates the unitive act from the procreative act, and at the other end of that spectrum, you know.
And not to mention a concern that's been brought up too is in vitro fertilization, when they create those embryos too, many of them are often discarded.
Yeah, yeah. And so there's this sort of slippery slope. IVF and the production of these excess embryos is one of the things that justifies, you know, embryonic stem cell research. We got all these excess embryos, we should do some. Use them for research. And so there's a lot of sort of ethical issues that flow from that, right? And it, at the heart of it, it is And it's difficult for an infertile couple, and my wife and I struggled with this for a couple of years in our marriage, and so it's not that the church doesn't have sympathy mm-hmm. for this, but the point there is that when you sort of I deserve to have a child, and sort of the commodification of another person, right? It's like I want a child, and I want to produce it this way, and I want it on my terms, which leads to a cheapening. Ironically, of life.
Okay, so a follow-up question to this that I think people would be interested in hearing, what are morally acceptable alternatives to IVF then for those who are practicing Catholics?
Yeah, so the church recognizes that people do struggle with infertility. What are their options, And so a lot of times, doctors just, they don't do much treatment. They just move you right to IVF mm-hmm. if you're not being able to conceive. But there's what's called NAPRO technology, which is, it's looking at the couple, woman, man, and trying to understand what it is that's leading to the infertility and doing research on, hormones and so forth that they can help, sort of chart what is it about the couple that might be able to be treated so that they can actually conceive a child. And so, the listeners that are interested, you can look up NAPRO technology. There's different doctors that are certified in this across the country, and they can really sit down and try to work with you rather than pushing you right away and just sort of ignoring what might be the underlying issue that might be treatable.
That's really helpful. I think, again, as this is so much in the news and a topic of conversation, that's really helpful for people to understand. Dan, thank you. And thanks again for another great episode together. And for listeners and viewers, make sure to go to MagiCenter.com for the latest on Purposeful Lab, and make sure to subscribe on all podcast platforms. We'll see you again next week.